Okay, we'll call to order the House Revenue Committee. Welcome, everybody, and I'm sorry for starting a little bit late this morning. I promise it won't happen again. Until perhaps the next opportunity.
Until the next time we start late.
We will reverse the order of our agenda this morning. I think we'll be able to make some quick work of House Bill 2339. That's my hope, anyway. Let's see if we can do that, because we do have a work session scheduled on that, at least for possible move into work session. And then we will just have a hearing after that on House Bill 2186. So, that said, let me open a public hearing on House Bill 2339. Mazin, if you want to give us the staff overview.
The Chair, the House Bill 2339 has to do with the requirements for exemptions and for the Housing Authority. Their main exemption clause of the statute is located somewhere else in the statute, so it takes it away from 307.112 and maintains, as I provided a copy of 456.225, the main body of the exemption statutes, and makes that statute as a part of Chapter 307. And in that sense, it leaves out the annual requirement for filing with the assessors on that leased property or leased-to-owned property. And since it's not moving anything drastically into exemption or out of exemption, it doesn't have any impact in the revenue sense.
All right. Let's hear from Phil Donovan and Paul Parker, if you gentlemen want to come up. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank
you. Good morning. Yeah.
Members of the committee, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities. This bill comes before you because the Housing Authority of Portland recently encountered conflict in the sense of having received a very large property tax bill as a result of the fact that ORS 307 basically has no reference to the fact that housing authorities have an absolute exemption for tax assessments under ORS 456.225. During the past interim, the general counsel to the Housing Authority of Portland brought this conflicting language to the attention of the Oregon Law Commission. Due to the relatively uncomplicated nature of the issue, the Oregon Law Commission declined to study the matter, and we were appreciative that Representative Shetterly, the chair, expressed a willingness to introduce legislation. So we brought the conflict to the attention of the board of the Association of Housing Authorities and determined that referencing ORS 456.225 into ORS 307.112 would be the preferred manner for dealing with this problem. And that is the change that is reflected in House Bill 2339. Now, this legislation is important because the tools that are available to create and maintain affordable housing are limited. In other words, the cost of bricks and mortars to a private developer or to a non-profit development corporation or to a housing authority pretty much costs the same. But by bringing things such as property tax assessments to the table, it really helps housing authorities' ability to provide affordable housing to low-income Oregonians. With me today is Paul Parker, who is the policy director at the Housing Authority of Portland, to share with you the specifics about how this came to light.
Okay. So before we go there, let me make sure that I've got this crystal clear. I should, since my name is on it. ORS 456.225 gives an absolute, or at least a continuing exemption to housing authorities. That is, a continuing property tax exemption to housing authorities, with the exception regarding property that's commercial property leased to a taxable entity. But for the most part, gives this property tax exemption to housing authorities and doesn't say they have to apply for it every year. So housing authorities look at that, and they don't go apply every year. But you've got, under current law, ORS 307-112, which is actually in the bill, and by referencing in that statute, ORS 456-225, it appears to create the responsibility or the need to reapply every year for a property tax exemption that in the reference statute is ongoing and not subject to an annual application. Is that what the issue is?
That's correct. And Mr. Chair, the problem was basically why this is so confounding to housing authorities across the state of Oregon is that they didn't know that this existed.
Sure. So the tax assessor looks at 307-112 and says, well, if you're exempt under 456-225, you have to apply every year. But if you look at 456-225, it says you don't have to apply right. every year.
That's correct.
Okay. Okay. Parker.
Good morning, Chair Shatley, members of the committee. My name is Paul Parker. I'm the Director of Policy and Planning for the Housing Authority of Portland. I'm going to read this testimony because I think it's probably simplest. We thought it might be helpful for the committee to know about the Housing Authority of Portland's specific experience of the conflict between ORS 456-225 and ORS 307-112. In a nutshell, in completing the transaction for the purchase of an affordable housing property in 1999, we did everything in compliance with ORS 456-225, which exempts housing authorities from property taxation. However, we ended up with a $64,000 tax bill from Multnomah County simply because we weren't aware of the provision under 307-112 that required us to file a claim of exemption with the county assessor. 456-225, which lies within the body of state law governing housing authorities, makes no reference to the need to file for exemption, nor does it reference ORS 307-112. There is a case for saying that we should have known of ORS 307-112 anyway, but we didn't. And there are no cross-references between the two statutes. The proposed remedy in House Bill 2339 ensures that public housing authorities in Oregon cannot be caught unawares in future. Finally, I can't overemphasize the importance of the property tax exemption. Without it, there's no way we can make affordable housing for Oregon's low-income residents pencil out. The money just isn't there. Thank you, Chair Shetley and members of the committee, for your interest and this opportunity to testify, and we urge your support for this bill.
Thank you. I guess the alternative would be to amend 456-225 to expressly require housing authorities to file every year, but that just
there's more than one way to skin a cat. Yeah,
for you and for the county assessor's office then too in processing these applications. I think we went the other direction yesterday in one of our bills. Any questions or comments, Representative Farr?
Thank you. I work with the housing authority quite a bit in Eugene as a member of the housing policy board, and occasionally it would come up where the other not-for-profits would claim that the Housing Authority Board had say unfair advantage in providing the services. Does this in any way address that? That is that the Housing Authority Board quite often got the bids on low-income housing projects that NEDCO and other nonprofits would think that they should have gotten the bid on, shall we say.
Would you like a comment?
If you have a comment.
My only comment would be that the solution to that, if the state of Oregon wants to provide affordable housing to people who otherwise can't afford it, would be to extend this to nonprofits, not to take it away from housing authorities, because the issue ultimately isn't who can do what. The issue is whether the state is going to facilitate the provision of affordable housing.
Well, in Eugene, quite often we pay the FTCs for affordable housing as well as well as the tax exemptions. Good, that's what I hope to hear. Thank you.
Representative Bridger.
I'm just curious. Haven't these ORSs been in the statute for quite a while, and why would you all of a sudden get a tax bill for $60,000 since they're not related? What prompted the assessor to change? Because you, affordable housing isn't new.
They have been in statute for quite a while, and as I trust I acknowledged, frankly, we paid it because we were supposed to pay it because we didn't file with the county assessor. You can put it down to housing authorities being very familiar with the housing authority section of the law, but not knowing that this was pocketed away in a completely different section of the law. And when they read ORS 456-225, the implication was that because they were tax exempt, they were tax exempt. Does that make sense? I mean, if it doesn't, it's a failure on my part to communicate, not a failure on your part to understand.
Well said.
I hasten to add.
Remember that, everyone. If we're ever confused, it's your fault.
Yeah. It's a fair question.
Well, I think probably, too. I mean, yeah, county assessors don't spend their lives poring over the statutes either, and I think there's probably the assumption on... in a lot of county offices as well, that if you're exempt, probably under that statute. And you may have come across a case where somebody had a little extra time on their hands and been reading the statutes and picked up on a change here that created some tax liability.
I mean, if I can go off text for one moment, Chair Shadley,
sure enough.
To me, this is an exercise in making the law work well for the people who are trying to use it. The law is already in place, but this is an exercise in improving the way it runs so that in practice ordinary folk trying to get the job done who are not all lawyers can do a better job for themselves and the people they serve.
Okay. Any other questions, comments?
Mazin? Let me add that 307.112 deals with property that is leased or leased to be purchased.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very narrow in that sense. So all property.
All right. Thank you very much. And does anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 2339? Hearing none, then I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2339. What's your pleasure,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Farr.
I move that we pass this House Bill 2339 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Farr moves House Bill 2339 to the floor with a due pass. Is there discussion?
A request, and this may be out of order, and let me know if it is. I'm very new at this. I understand that you presented this bill, and I would like to request carrying it.
You certainly may.
Thank you.
Yeah. Assuming, of course, that it passes.
Assuming,
yeah. Okay, if there's no further... The options are either to extend the reporting or the filing requirement every year to housing authorities, which seems to me a lot of make work, or to decide that we're going to tax, you know, other nonprofits. I'm not sure. That's a bigger issue, obviously, whatever that inequity may be between housing authorities and nonprofits. But I'm not inclined to do something that's going to make housing more expensive and decrease our stock of affordable housing in Oregon. So this seems to me, among the options before us, the thing to do this morning.
Yes.
Let's call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Farr?
Aye.
Cass?
Aye.
Austin?
Aye.
Guy?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
William?
Aye.
Hi. House Bill 2339 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Farr will carry it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay. We've got a substitution. Checking in at the bench. And now, entering the game for LRO. We have before us, colleagues, the biennial Reconnect bill, which gives us a chance to look at federal tax law changes that have occurred in the last 2 years that do not come under the automatic reconnect with that we have under current law with the federal tax code defining taxable income. And so today we welcome the Society of Certified Public Accountants, and W. Buchanan, I guess, is going to be pitching for the Revenue Department to walk us through the bill and the report that is always a helpful tool in seeing what's in the bill. But before we begin, let me open a public hearing in case I've not done that on House Bill 2186. And Elizabeth, if you'll give us the overview before we get into the testimony.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2186, as the chair just stated, Deborah Buchanan will go through the bill, so I won't go through all the details of it. But just to give you a big overview again of what we're doing here is we have rolling reconnect here in Oregon. So that basically is saying that we are automatically connecting to changes in the definition of taxable income as they are incorporated into the Internal Revenue Code. And we have had this since 1997, and prior to that, Oregon income tax was just tied to a particular year in federal income tax code. So what you're seeing before you today will not have a revenue impact, but the rolling reconnect obviously has had a revenue impact. So what I've given you just for your own information here is a summary of the Oregon's income tax reconnect recent history. And basically it goes through some of these major acts that the CPAs will discuss in great detail today, but just so you can get a broad overview of what the revenue impact is from that rolling reconnect, you can see it broken out here by the different acts. And the first one most recently in 2002 was the Job Creation and Worker Assistance Act of 2002. And this, the basic major component here was the Bonus Depreciation Act. And so with that, we saw that there was a revenue loss then in 2001-03 of $105 million. And then in outer years, 2003-05 biennium at $69 million. But then you see that there is also then in the future years, there's going to be a subsequent increase of 2005-07 of $71 million. And the reason why that is because you're basically just taking more depreciation up front. You're allowing this additional bonus 30% depreciation. And then in future years, you can't take as much depreciation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Will this eventually then, if you go out to 07-09, will this eventually then equalize out? It'll be a wash?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Haas, that's correct. And then in 2001, we had the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act, and this was basically had real had the estate tax changes in there, and also it had the reducing of the tax rates, increasing deductions, and some exclusions and credit. And the dollar amount for that was basically estimated at $21 million in 2001-03. And then the net increase then overall, because you also had the feedback effect, as we were talking about before, an orientation that when you have these reductions of the federal income tax, then that feeds through to Oregon as far as having a smaller than federal tax subtraction. So with both the feedback effects as well as the reduction, you see then a net increase of roughly $40 million in the 2001-03 biennium and $34 million in the 2003-05 biennium. And then in 2000, you had the Community Renewal Tax Relief Act of 2000 and also the Foreign Sales Corporation Repeal and Extraterritorial Income Exclusion Act. So those two bills together reduced Oregon's collections by roughly $21 million in 2001-03 and $27 million in 2003-05. And then in the 1999, there was only a minor impact due to the Tax Relief Extension Act of 1999, where it was a reduction of $1 million in 2001-03 biennium. And then in 1998, we also connected with the IRS Restructuring and Reform Act, and it estimated an increase of $1 million in 2001-03 biennium. So all of these, and so everyone's clear, all of these, you know, impacts get translated into our forecast. So, you know, as we're making these estimates on the impact on federal law changes, they get transferred to OEA and put into our economic forecast, and then eventually they just become part of our baseline then for our forecast.
Okay. Any questions? Well, that's very helpful. Very, very good report. Questions for Elizabeth before we invite our witnesses forward? Okay, then let's do that. I see Rob. Did you want to come forward? Deborah, are you coming first? Okay. Deborah Buchanan.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. And I've prepared for you a section-by-section analysis of House Bill 2186. And I thought I would just quickly go through that. It's fairly short. Sections 1 through 14 of the bill are changing an existing date in the Oregon statutes to December 31, 2002. The reason we need this is Oregon law only allows you to do a rolling reconnect or automatic conformity to the definition of federal taxable income. There are other references in the Internal Revenue Code to the Internal Revenue Code in Oregon law, and those need to be date specific. So that's what you see in the bill in sections 1 through 14. And actually, section 14 of the bill contains both the automatic conformity provision and a specific tie date to those other provisions. So that's what the first 14 pages of the bill do. Section 14 has in subsection 1 is the automatic conformity, and then subsection 2 has a tie date to other provisions not related to the definition of federal taxable income. Section 15 of the bill, we had a small problem with the way the words in the Oregon statute exist now. And the problem was that Congress passed a law in 2002 relating to extending the carryback period for net operating losses. That period went from 2 years to 5 years for federal purposes. And ordinarily, Oregon would just pick that up, which we did for 2002. But the words in the statute prevented us from doing that for 2001 because it talks about the Internal Revenue Code as it existed at the end of the year. The change that was made by Congress in 2002 was retroactive. So when you looked at what existed at the end of 2001, it was a two-year carryback. So we had that one small discrepancy for 2001. So that's what's happening in Section 15, is that's being reworded slightly to take care of that. Sections 16 through 17 of the bill are dealing with deferred compensation plans that are offered by state and local government, and it's conforming there to changes in federal treatment. The federal law now treats those as distributions similar to distributions from pension plans, employer-provided retirement plans, where previously they had been treated as wages, distributions of wages. So there's a disconnect there between Oregon law and federal law just as to the withholding requirement on the distributions, and this would conform to the federal provisions. Section 18 is picking up just a minor change in Oregon law or federal law. When they put in the Roth IRA provisions, they created a new section in the Internal Revenue Code, Section 408, capital A. The reference in Oregon law is to the Internal Revenue Code sections 401 through 408, so it doesn't pick up that new code section. This is a fairly minor change to pick up that new provision. The other sections of the bill, Section 19, again, is a date change in the corporate tax statutes, so that date is changing to 12/31/2002. The balance of the changes are either restatements or clarifications. For example, Section 20 is simply taking out a specific reference to the Internal Revenue Code and replacing it with a general reference. Section 21, there are references to section, but it's not clear that they're sections of the Internal Revenue Code. And the same thing applies for Section 22. We have a reference to a provision of federal law that's no longer in existence, so we're correcting that. The one thing that I did want to talk about specifically is Section 24, which is really restating the Oregon statute. In 2000, Congress placed limits on the state's ability to tax certain non-residents. And the non-residents in this case are those with regularly assigned duties on the waters of two states. So the intention, as stated at Congress, was when you have the pilots of the barges or the tugboats running up and down the Columbia River, and those individuals are residents of Washington, that Oregon would not be able to tax them for the period of time that they're on the Oregon side of the river. That was the federal law passed in 2000. In the 2001 session, that was also placed into Oregon law. There were slight differences in the wording, and there was a little bit of concern raised that perhaps the Oregon law was broader than the federal limitation, such that not only that compensation would be exempted, but other types of compensation could be exempted for the non-residents. So this is simply intending to reflect the limits that are in existence at the federal level and not to extend beyond that. So clarifying language. And the others are primarily housekeeping changes in the bill and the applicability date, effective date. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer those, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Deborah? Representative Pass.
Mr. Chair, I guess this is more for you. Oh, a lot of this is just technical housekeeping. How does this relate to some of the other larger discussions we've had about unconnecting on some of these issues?
That won't be the subject of today's discussion.
I understand
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, I think.
Can we do this and that?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, if we were to disconnect for the purpose of the definition of taxable income, which is the point where we are connected, then what you would see in this session and succeeding sessions would be the same kind of discussion about specific changes in federal law relating to the definition of taxable income, and then we would make a determination on a case-by-case issue to whether to reconnect or not. So it's very much related.
Yeah.
The only reason we don't see this kind of bill dealing with issues related to the definition of taxable income is something that we have an ongoing connection.
Well, I just wanted to make sure that this, if we do that later, this that isn't undoing
no.
something that we've already done.
No. Representative Barnett.
Thank you. We haven't had this conversation. I don't know if this is the appropriate time to ask.
Sure.
Is it your intention to have a conversation about
yes.
that issue?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Representative Berger.
I want to be sure that I understand Section 24. In the year 2000, the non-residents were subject to tax by the state that they lived in. So if they lived in Washington State, they were taxed there. If they lived in Oregon and worked on the Columbia, then that would be in some way different.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, Oregon taxes the income, all income of an Oregon resident, regardless of where that is earned. For a non-resident, Oregon tax is income that is sourced to Oregon. So if you have a person living in Vancouver who works in Portland in an office, that compensation that they receive for working in Oregon is taxable by Oregon. By the same token, prior to 2000, if you had a non-resident who worked as a pilot on one of the barges and their job took them up and down the Columbia River every day,
right.
For the period of time they were in Oregon waters, that compensation would be sourced to Oregon. So they would have been taxable by Oregon for the portion that they spent on the Oregon side of the river.
Follow up, Mr.
Mm-hmm.
Chair?
Mm-hmm.
Then why would there be any concern about it being broader than the federal? It says here that it might be broader unintentionally, exempting other types of income by non-residents.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, on page 21 of the bill, in line 43, the words are being added to that section, so it will now read, compensation for the performance of duties described in this subsection. So it's trying to clarify that what is exempt is the pay that they're receiving for the duties they perform on the river and working in the waterways of two states. They would not be exempted, for example, if they're a pilot, but their job has them sitting at a terminal in Oregon for the entire year. Even though they're a pilot, their compensation would not be exempt because they're in Oregon, working in Oregon. They're not on the river going up and down the waterways of two states.
One last,
yes, sure.
One last
mm-hmm.
question. So when it says, as stated in federal law, that refers back to state of residence?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, that refers to the law that was passed by Congress in 2000 that gives the protection to certain non-residents.
The full law.
Yes.
All right.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Other questions? This is one of the things when you live in Dallas and you work in a little law practice, you have no idea that we worry about what side of the river these barges are traveling on for Oregon income tax purposes.
Mr. Chairman, I imagine at some point it's difficult to determine based on what side of the boat you were standing on at that point in time.
In effect, there may be, there could be tax planning.
Yeah, that's right. Everybody on the right
starboard.
Side. Starboard, port. Starboard.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I can assure you there are people in Coos Bay that are very worried about exactly how that tax is going to take place.
All right. Any other questions for Ms. Buchanan? Thank you very much. Let's bring up our CPAs. We have Rob Douglas and Kim Spaldane. Welcome back. Kim Spaulding, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rob Douglas, representing the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants. With me today on my right is Kim Spaulding. She will be joined in her presentation by Bruce Crone and Robert Karras. Also in the audience today is Marianne Brams, president of the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants. Mr. Chairman, this is part of our commitment to the Legislative Assembly, that every 2 years we come before the Revenue Committees and describe to you the changes that have taken place in federal tax law and how that affects Oregon tax code. We have provided a booklet to the committee, which our witnesses will take you through. First, they will describe how the booklet is put together and what the various codes mean, and then they'll talk about the actual technical provisions in that booklet.
Very good. All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Baldwin.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, can you hear me okay?
Just a little bit closer.
Is that better?
That's better.
Okay. So in front of you is our analysis of the seven acts that were passed since you've last met. And what we've done, on the front is a list of those acts, just as you heard earlier. And the analysis is broken out into three sections, and we have called them recommendations A, B, and C. Recommendation A describes federal changes that automatically fall under Oregon's automatic reconnect, and therefore you don't need to proactively do anything to change or tie to federal law. Recommendation B, and if you go to the tabs, you can see there's a description there. So if you go to the tab A, it describes what I just told you. Tab B is, it doesn't apply to Oregon because Oregon doesn't prescribe to that particular credit, or it's an administrative provision that doesn't apply to Oregon. So, and then recommendation C are changes that we feel need, if you were to want to tie to federal, you would need to change the law. So I would recommend that we start with recommendation C and discuss those first, and then go back to the A's, and then you can hear about what federal law changes that are falling under Oregon's automatic reconnect. So on section C, Bob Karras is going to talk first on the estate and gift provisions. Do you have any other questions?
No, any questions first analysis? About the format of the approach? Okay, let's go ahead.
Good morning, Representative Shetterly and members of the committee. My name is Robert Karras, certified public accountant, and I'm here to represent the Oregon Society of CPAs. And I'm beginning with our presentation this morning on page 30 of our booklet, Recommendation C. Again, Recommendation C talks about those areas of the federal tax law that have changed, which are not automatically incorporated into which do not fall under the ambit of automatic reconnect, but which we believe the legislature needs to be aware of in terms of making sure that taxpayers are able to comply efficiently and accurately with the law, and make sure that the Department of Revenue is is able to enforce the law fairly and easily. I'm going to skip over Section 411 because, as Kim will tell you later, Section 411, the very first thing on page 30, really belongs under Section A, and we just had a change of heart about it on the way down here. So we're going to start with the
Section. Is that easy?
Yeah, just kind of we're going to go with the flow on that. So we're starting off with the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act of 2001, whose enactment date was June 7th of 2001. And the first section that we're going to talk about is sections 531 to 532. And those are changes to the estate, gift, and generation skipping transfer tax provisions. So in Oregon's context, we're talking about the inheritance tax. Federal law has for years defined a credit against the inheritance against the federal estate tax, which allows Oregon to define its own inheritance tax. And basically what happens is that the federal law says up to this limit a state can assess a tax against the decedent, and there won't be any increase in the overall tax burden on the estate. But what's happening with the federal law, and Oregon has just taken full advantage of that credit with the idea that there shouldn't be an additional burden, apparently, that there shouldn't be an additional burden on the decedent's estate. Federal tax law, as you know, is changing, and the federal estate tax is going away slowly but surely over the next 7 years. And one of the changes to the federal estate tax is that this credit is also going away. In other words, the credit that Oregon takes advantage of is going to be phased out and eventually disappear. One of the things then that Oregon needs to be aware of is that that source of revenue is going to be diminishing if the legislature takes no further action. So, and I understand then that, and that's really all I have to say about that particular feature. But I do understand that there are a couple of bills that are under consideration which acknowledge that and take some of that into account and deal with that in different sorts of ways.
Yeah, thank you. I think for our purposes this morning in committee, I think we probably can save the discussion for estate and inheritance tax for another day because we will have some specific legislation coming forward on that.
Representative Chatterley, that's a good point.
Thank you.
And that's the end of my little presentation so far.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bruce Crone. I'm CPA in Oregon City, and I'm representing the Oregon Society of CPAs. And I'm going to be giving a presentation basically on the pension and IRA provisions of EGTRA, the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act of 2001. And the Act section I'm going to talk about now is 641. This is the one that Deborah alluded to earlier. It goes to the definition of how you treat deferred compensation in 457 plans. For federal, they're treated as wages. For state, they're treated as a deferred compensation. So this creates some nonconformity problems, and the purpose of this provision, which is section 16 and 17 of 2186, is to deals with the withholding requirements.
I'll continue on with the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Act of 2001. They changed and delayed corporate estimated taxes by 15 days in 2004. They have extended tax deadlines for presidentially declared disasters, and I'm just continuing on from pages 30 to 31. Both of those items are addressed in Senate Bill 221. We think 801 might or might not be. So you'll be hearing about that.
Okay.
The sunset provision in Act Section 901, you probably heard about, basically repeals the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Act in 2011. So everything that you hear about goes away. So, interesting twist.
Yeah.
So on to the Victims of Terrorism Tax Relief Act of 2001. These provisions mostly relate to September 11th, the Oklahoma City in 1995, and the anthrax attacks. So Act Section 101 and 113 on the next page extend relief for income taxes for people involved in that. That is also addressed in House Bill 2186. The Act Section 103 reduces the estate tax for victims of those acts. Oregon does not have this special provision currently. 112 allows the authority to postpone certain deadlines. Again, Senate Bill 221, Oregon has its own deadlines currently. And that's it for that Victims Act. The Job Creation and Worker Assistance Act of 2002. Bruce was going to talk about the net operating loss.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Job Creation and Worker Assistance Act of 2002 created a net operating loss carryback of 5 years for individuals and corporations. For Oregon, corporations do not have a carryback. They have a carry-forward provision, so this only affects individuals in Oregon. And as Deborah mentioned earlier, Oregon's statute refers to, the language refers to the close of the year. And so there needs to be a little change in the language so that any changes in federal law will apply retroactively, as in this case. Currently, you will have a 5-year carryback for individuals and only a 2-year carryback for Oregon for tax year 2001. For 2002, we're in conformity, so this provision just relates to 2001.
And this amendment is addressed in House Bill 2186.
That's correct. Section 15 of the bill.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the last two Act sections are tax technical corrections. The first one, 411, refers to Act Section 531 and 532 on page 30. And those are technical corrections related to gifts and estate tax. The last one, Act Section 412, clarifies that a child will remain a dependent if they are found missing up until age 18 or they're determined to be dead. And that is addressed in House Bill 2186. So that brings us to the end of our recommendation C, in which we believe Oregon does not automatically tie. We can go back to our recommendations A on page 1. And
I guess before we leave C, if I can, then do I understand that you may have some amendments or proposed amendments to 2186 in areas that it doesn't address? It seemed to me there was one that you said you weren't sure if the bill connected.
I believe that was Senate Bill 221, and that is just in the wording of the bill. We're not sure. It gives leeway as to when the department has the authority to make changes.
Okay.
So that's outside of this 2186.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Then back to A. Is that where we are?
Correct.
Okay.
Page 1. So Bob Karras is going to talk you through the FISC repeal and Extraterritorial Income Exclusion Act.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it's my honor to talk about the FISC repeal. And actually, this here again is another example of a provision in the federal law which is under consideration separately in a different House bill. Prior to November 15th of 2000, the federal statute had in place something called a foreign sales corporation, a corporation who is in the business of exporting goods or services overseas could take advantage of the foreign sales corporation provisions and lower its federal income tax. The state of Oregon did not allow that adjustment to be made and, in essence, disregarded the existence of the foreign sales corporation. Effective with the FISC repeal and Extraterritorial Income Exclusion Act, a mouthful act of 2000, the federal government, under pressure from its foreign trading partners, decided to enact a different regime called the Extraterritorial Income Tax Act. And the EIT rules basically do the same thing as the Foreign Sales Corp rules for an exporting corporation, except no external corporation is now needed. No foreign sales corporation is needed. You simply make an adjustment to your taxable income, and bang, you have less tax to pay because of these nice exports you've been doing. The key for you folks to keep in mind is that Oregon tax law automatically adopts those changes, and a corporation who is an exporter will automatically have, under Oregon law, the benefit of that subtraction in calculating their Oregon income tax. Now, I understand that there's a bill in front of the of the legislature that repeals that benefit. Let's see, that's HB 2182, effective January 1st of 2003. But keep in mind that under automatic reconnect, that this benefit has been legally taken advantage of by Oregon taxpayers, corporate taxpayers, effective with basically 2001. Kim?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, so on to page 2, the Community Renewal Tax Relief Act of 2000. Act sections 101, 102, and 116 provide tax relief for renewal community tax incentives and empowerment zone tax incentives. Those create tax deductions and some deferrals of gains on sale of assets. Act section 162 extends and expands the expensing of environmental remediation costs. And I'm just going to breeze through these. Feel free to stop me if you have questions. Act section 165 extends and modifies the deduction for corporate donations of computer technology for educational purposes. Act section 202 makes changes to medical savings accounts. 401 changes the tax treatment of securities futures contracts. Deals with whether the income is capital gain or ordinary. The Installment Tax Correction Act had one item it was changing. It repealed the limitation that was placed on the original repeal of the installment tax. So it basically got rid of the repeal of the installment method. The Economic Growth and Tax Relief Act of 2001, Act Section 103, increased the starting point for the phase-out of itemized deductions. 202 expanded the adoption credit and adoption assistance programs. 204 deals with the dependent care tax credit, and tax benefits have been increased. 303 changes the earned income credit and deals with the phase out level of income for joint filers. 401 expands and modifies the education IRAs. 402 modifies qualified tuition programs.
If you could just stop for a second there, just
sure.
Not so much pertinent to this, but do you have a comment on what the President has proposed and Congress is considering on these now these savings plans, sort of the super savings plans? What effect they're likely to have on things like qualified tuition programs? I mean, is it going to render those obsolete if I'm trying to think of the plan. You know the ones I'm talking about.
I'm not familiar with this super savings plan.
Well,
are you?
Oh, really? Okay. Anybody else know? It's just under consideration. It's savings accounts you can move money into and basically withdraw tax free for any purpose. Is that
Yeah, I'm not.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. Never mind. It wasn't pertinent anyway.
On page 5, Act Section 412, it expands the student loan interest deduction. 413 excludes amounts received for scholarship programs from income. 431 provides for a deduction of higher education expenses above the line rather than as a miscellaneous itemized deduction. And I believe that brings us to Bob Paris, who's going to talk again about the estate and gift tax.
Again, my name is Bob Karras, Representative Shetterly, and members of the committee. On page 6, we're looking at the estate, gift, and generation skipping transfer tax provisions of the 2001 tax law change. Basically, what happens here is that there are carryover basis rules, and the federal law harmonizes the rules regarding carryover basis for property inherited from a decedent. Under current law, the heir receives the property with a stepped up basis. So when it's sold, it has a new, presumably higher basis where less capital gains tax would be imposed if the property were sold by the heir. Because the federal estate tax is ultimately going to be repealed, the federal government said that, well, one of the things we can recapture some of that revenue is we can eliminate the carryover, the step-up in basis and require people to take a carryover basis. There's also another feature, and that is that that at the that talks about how the exclusion works for a the sale of a personal residence. Currently, when a person inherits a personal residence from a decedent, that person has not lived in that home, perhaps, and is not eligible to take the exclusion of capital gains tax on the on any gain that might be realized on the sale of that residence. But the new the tax law changes effective in 01 allow now the heir to stand in the shoes of the decedent and take advantage of the $250,000 exclusion.
On the, and let me ask if I can on the carryover and the step-up in basis. I see that from the report it looks like that change to a carryover basis occurs or begins in 2010. So until then we have a step-up, a full step-up in basis. Is that it?
Yes,
for inherited property?
Yes, Representative Shetterly, that is correct.
And so since that's the year that the estate tax is fully repealed, I assume that for now anyway that carryover in basis is only going to be in effect for a year under current law, because then it all reverts back to 1997 law and you get back to the stepped-up basis?
I believe, Representative, that that is correct, that if the federal tax law goes as scheduled, that this provision will only be effective for 1 year and cause a complete nightmare for everyone involved.
That is amazing.
It is bizarre.
Mr. Chairman, that means I need to make sure that Dad keeps in the house for a few more years, it sounds like, huh?
Well, no, you get your step-up in basis until 2010. You lose your step-up in basis in 2010. I don't want to get into, there's two more, but you know.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
The secret, of course, is not to die that year.
Well, it depends.
No, with all due respect to your consideration here, that in fact, everyone, the people who comment on these things say this is the push the dad from the airplane act of because.
but wait a second. But wait a second. Now, does that elimination of the carry of the step up apply to? Let me see. Right now, if you've got an estate that's not taxable, you still get the step-up in basis.
That's
so in 2010, if you have an estate that wouldn't have been taxable under previous law, you lose the benefit, or your heirs lose the benefit of the step-up, but you don't get any benefit from the elimination of the estate tax because you weren't going to pay estate tax anyway.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and that is correct with one exception, and I think that the rule that I didn't bother to go into was there is a rule, as always, rules within rules, and there is a mitigation provision with respect to the step up, and that is that for a small enough size estate, perhaps all the assets in the estate would be stepped up, and that the cap on that is $1.3 million. So the type of estate you're talking about, one that wouldn't be taxable prior to the total repeal of the estate tax, like let's say in 2009,
right.
would have a taxable estate of $3 million. Let's say that someone had an estate of around $1 million, they would get a full step up in basis anyway, so the heirs would be treated as they would have under the prior law, even in 2010. Okay. So there's no advantage to pulling the plug.
It's so bizarre.
It's sort of like being in Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, thank
That's
you.
That's the end of my bit.
A little diversion down the rabbit hole.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to be speaking for about the next five or six pages on pension and IRAs, so I'll try to be brief. To the best of my knowledge, Oregon is always connected with the pension and IRA provisions. Act Section 601 increases the IRA contribution limits over several years from 3,000 to 2004. It also allows catch-up contributions for those reaching the golden age of 50. Those start at 500 and so on up to 1,000. The purpose of this provision is to get people to put money away as quickly as possible in the event that Social Security is not there for them.
I'll bet you wouldn't find that in the record.
Of course, the way the market's going, where you put the money is another question. Act Section 602 allows for the creation of a qualified deemed IRA as part of a qualified employer's plan. The purpose of this is to allow for a separate account to be created if you happen to like your employer's pension plan, and you can put IRA money there. Act Section 611, qualified plan benefit and contribution limits are increased after 2001. So defined contribution plan limits go to $40,000 and defined benefit plans go to $160,000. It also increases the elective deferrals if you have 401ks. Those start at $11,000 now in 2002, an increase in increments of $1,000 on up to $15,000. And simple plans have corresponding increases. They start at $7,000 and go to $10,000. Act Section 613 is the rules on top-heavy plans are modified, and the definition of a key employee is simplified after 2001, and this is to allow plans to retain their qualified plan status. Act Section 614, elective deferrals are no longer taken into account in applying employer plan contribution deduction limits. In the past, if you had an elective deferral, you had to use the compensation net of the deferral for calculating the employer contribution, and now you don't include the deferral. It gives the employee a larger contribution. Act Section 615 deals with the coordination requirements for calculating deferred limit for deferred compensation plan of tax-exempt organizations and state and local governments. This is Code Section 457 deferrals. They used to have to be coordinated with other code section deferrals like 401ks, 403bs, and they're no longer coordinated with those. 616 deals with limitations on deductible contributions to profit sharing or stock bonus plans. They're increased to 25% from 15%, and money purchase pension plans are also subject to a 25%. Those used to be 10%. This increases the deduction of the employer as he makes these contributions. Act Section 617 deals with 401k and 403b plans, treating 2005 elective deferrals as after-tax Roth IRA contributions. This takes effect beginning in 2006. It allows these plans to set up a separate account for Roth IRAs. Act Section 631 deals with catch-up contributions for people reaching that golden age of 50 and over. It allows them to increase the amount that they can defer through 401ks, 403bs, 457s. Act Section 632 deals with equitable treatment for contributions of employees to defined contribution plans. It increases the percentage from 25% to 100%. There's some controversy about this. Who can afford to put aside 100% of compensation? And effectively what it does is it allows people to contribute more than 25%. And it's made, once again, to make up for people that haven't set aside enough money. Act Section 635 clarifies the tax treatment of division of IRC 457 plan benefits upon divorce. This is what we call quadros. In other words, if a pension plan splits because of a divorce and you have a distribution to the spouse, it's taxable to the spouse, and this makes 457 plan quadros treated similarly. Act Section 641 talks about rollovers among various types of plans. In the past, you couldn't roll over contributions between certain retired qualified retirement plans, and now you can. It allows people, as they move from employer to employer, to roll over their pension plans with one employer into the pension plan of another. Act Section 642 talks about rollovers allowed for IRAs into workplace retirement plans. This is similar to the 641 Act section. It's an act that allows you to roll an IRA into a pension plan at an employer. Act Section 643 talks about rollovers for after-tax contributions to IRAs and other qualified plans. Act Section 644 talks about the hardship exception to the 60-day rule. In the past, You have 60 days expired between the time that you took a distribution and before you rolled it over, you were out of luck. You had to report it as taxable income. This now allows for a hardship exception, and that way you can escape including it in taxable income. On page 10, Act Section 647 talks about purchase of service credit under governmental pension plans. Direct trustee to trustee transfers from a 403B annuity or 457 plan to a defined benefit government plan will not be includable in gross income. Act Section 649, minimum distribution and inclusion requirements for 457 plans. Amounts deferred under a 457 plan are includable income when paid, not when made available. So it's a matter of definition there. Act Section 651 talks about current liability full funding limit is accelerated for plans after 2001 and repeal for plans beginning after 2004. This defines how much you can deduct as part of the contribution. Act Section 652 talks about a defined benefit plan deduction, which is allowed for unfunded current liability. Act Section 654 talks about a defined benefit plan, 100% of compensation benefit limit, which is eliminated for multi-employer plans. Act Section 656 talks about prohibited allocations of stock in an S-corporation ESOP. Act Section 658, clarification of treatments of contributions to a multi-employer plan. Act Section 662, ESOP dividends may be reinvested without a loss of a dividend deduction. And Act Section 665, treatment of employer plan, employer provided retirement advice. This allows you to exclude from income and wages if you have someone come in and talk to your employees about a qualified plan. And the last one I'm going to talk about is Act Section 667, which deals with the Alaska Native Settlement Trust, and it has to do with reporting taxable income on a distribution. Normally, we wouldn't be concerned about it in Oregon, but you could have a circumstance where an Oregon filer is an Alaska resident and therefore has this exclusion applying on their federal return. And I'll turn it over to Kim now.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'd like to point you, you don't have to turn, but page 30, Act Section 411, which is actually Recommendation A, extends the exclusion for employer-provided educational assistance. On page 12, restitution received by Holocaust victims is excludable from income. In the Victims of Terrorism Tax Relief Act, they have made some exclusions from income for death benefits related, again, to the September 11th, the Oklahoma City and the anthrax attacks. And they have also provided that in Act Section 105 that any discharge of indebtedness income may be excluded from income in those instances. Act Section 111 also provides for the exclusion of disaster relief payments. And Act Section 116 provides a personal exemption deduction for a disability trust.
Let me stop you for a second. Go back to your comment, taking us back to page 30 again. That extension of exclusion for employer-provided educational assistance. I guess what you're saying, are you saying that that's not so much inviting a policy choice? You're saying that you think that really falls into the automatic reconnect and not under the optional reconnect. That's just sort of a change in your analysis of how that applies?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. We believe it falls under the definition of taxable income.
Okay.
Under the automatic reconnect.
Okay. Very good.
Now we are at the Job Creation and Worker Assistance Act of 2002. And Bruce is going to talk about the depreciation allowance.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I know you discussed earlier when Deborah was up here about the special depreciation allowance. This is a 30% depreciation bonus on property placed in service after September 10th, 2001 and before September 11th, 2004. It will only affect tax years 2001 through 2004 as far as the bonus depreciation allowance. There's also in Act Section 301
New York City tax incentives due to the terrorist attack in New York. They have a 30% depreciation allowance extending to non-residential real property and residential rental property, and they have certain leasehold benefits that qualify for a five-year write-off, and they have a higher limit on writing off purchased assets. Once again, it's possible that you could have an Oregon taxpayer that has New York City either business activities or he's in New York City and filing an Oregon return, and so this would affect adjustments in the federal return.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Act Section 402 provides a law that overrides a Supreme Court decision that doesn't allow cancellation of indebtedness income that's excluded in an S-corp to increase the shareholder's basis in an S-corporation. Act Section 403 puts a limitation of the non-accrual method of accounting on certain businesses and services. Act Section 404 excludes income from foster care payments. The exclusion has been expanded. Excuse me. Act Section 405 provides an expanded rate of interest rates that's allowed in using calculating a plan's current liability. And Act Section 406 provides for a $250 deduction for classroom materials for teachers that is now above the line rather than an itemized deduction. Act Sections 411, 412, and 414 through 418 are technical corrections to the various tax acts that we're hearing about today. They employer-provided adoption assistance and pension-related amendments and phase-out rules related to rental real estate losses, basis reduction, various technical corrections that really don't have an impact.
Thank you. I want to back up one. I just realized I'm not certain that I know what you're talking about. I just want to inquire. In 406.
Where have you been?
My goodness.
Well, I was following up to this point, but I want to make certain. In 406, above the line means as a subtraction before you get to adjusted gross income. Is that right?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Yes,
Representative Berger.
Can you go back to 404? What is the exclusion from income for foster care payments? I didn't know it existed. It's
been
expanded.
I don't know either. This Act section expands the existing law, and I'm not familiar with the exclusion. I'm guessing, well, I don't know. I shouldn't guess.
I guess it's ironic that the federal government is expanding the exclusion from income while we are reducing the compensation to foster care.
Yeah, apparently there is an exclusion. I didn't realize it was even in the tax law.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Berger, when a person is engaged in the trade or business of operating a foster care facility, that net income from that the operation of that facility is a non-taxable transaction to the operator. I think the idea, and I can't really speak for the federal purpose behind this, but it seems to me that it's to expand the amount of foster care and to make sure that foster care is being provided at the lowest possible cost. But I'm not familiar with the nature of the expansion.
Follow up. No. Does that include if you were just, you know, a family that takes in foster care and you, it doesn't have to be facility based, and you are paid for taking care of foster children, is that excluded from income tax under federal?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Berger, that is essentially correct. I believe that there are, of course, licensing requirements. I'm not totally familiar with the nature of the industry, but in fact, many of these foster care providers do operate facilities out of their own homes for, you know, let's say adult foster care and so forth. Yes. Correct.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, not that I didn't understand every single word in here. I may curl up by the fire and read it this weekend. But I want to make sure I understand that these things in Section A that we did go through are ones that you feel professionally are not worthy of note. We go ahead and move forward with these.
we believe these items fall within the definition of taxable income for federal income taxes, which Oregon currently ties to. That's all we're saying. And we're just identifying them as items that did change since you guys met in 2001.
So in a sense, it's really not so much a recommendation. It's labeled recommendations, but it's really not so much a recommendation as it is a status report on changes in federal law that in your opinion, come under the rolling reconnect that we have under current law.
Correct.
Representative Barnhart.
Well, if I understand it correctly, it is the position of of the association of the society that we should connect whenever possible because it makes preparing returns simpler and keeping business records and personal records much easier to do if we have one system that we're all operating under rather than several different systems. Now that's sort of the bias that you operate from in general, isn't it?
This might be a good time to introduce our society president.
Sure.
Marianne, would you like to?
But I guess in fairness to you all, come on. In fairness to you all, that's really not a recommendation that is pertinent to this bill.
Correct.
This bill, in the context of this bill, these are simply observations.
Correct.
I think the question of their policy recommendation on going forward, whether we stay connected or not, is one thing, but I think what we've got here is just a status report as to current law.
Mr. Welcome. Chairman and committee members, if I might address Representative Barnhart's question.
Oh, if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Marianne Brams. I'm the current chair of the board of the Oregon Society of CPAs. Rob introduced me as president earlier, but just to clear up any possible future misunderstanding, my actual title is chair. We have a full-time staff president who runs our operation. I'm the head volunteer. We've actually had a very lively debate around this issue over the last week or so. We somehow guessed this question might come up. And as you aptly understand, we have worked very hard over the last many years to make sure that the folks in your position are well aware of the difficulties when there are inconsistencies between the Federal Internal Revenue Code and the state tax provisions. It makes compliance very difficult and expensive for taxpayers, and it makes administration difficult and expensive from the Department of Revenue's perspective. However, we understand political reality, and we understand the fiscal difficulties of the state at this point. So to the extent, and it's not our job to make political decisions, it's merely our job to help you understand the ramifications of the various alternatives. And to that end, our recommendation has always been for ease of administration and for ease of compliance to be as consistent as possible. If that becomes politically non-feasible, then we can help you decide which different alternatives will sort of minimize the burden on both sides. If you find it necessary to disconnect in certain ways. And, you know, starting kind of at the top of the list, we would say, in general, it helps if we don't make any retroactive changes. In general, it helps if we have fewer timing differences and fewer things that require separate sets of records. And there are other kinds of things that we can say in general. But until you have started to look at some specifics, we would like to not try to make any big blanket recommendations. And so even though our historical position has been reconnect, mm-hmm. We understand this is a different time and a different environment, and we would like to work with you and be part of the solution if you decide you need to do something different.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the comments, Representative
Bergen. Just very well stated. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, it is a concern, you know, when you've got potential for let's say, an ending balance for us, for 03-05, that could be swallowed whole by subsequent changes in federal tax law that that eats up our entire ending balance, and then some. I think I've used the analogy. It's a little bit like being a dinghy tethered to a submarine. I mean, the state is the dinghy, and the federal government is the submarine, and they can deficit spend, so they can do all this fancy stuff with tax incentives that may lead them into deficit, submerge basically for several years at a time before they have to worry about coming up for air. And we don't have the capacity to submerge. If we stay tethered, we just sink. And also, I guess there's the issue of sort of ceding to the federal government then the responsibility for making tax policy choices that basically we can't make them because they've occupied the field. They've used up all of our fund money. And so that it does present not only political but I think practical issues as well for us in this period of declining revenues at the state level.
Exactly. And we have not with us today, and not myself, but some of our volunteers have been part of this effort for many, many years and have that perspective and are can tell us that when we didn't do it automatically every 2 years, we still dealt with it. I mean, it can be done. It's not fun for anybody. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more work for you guys. I mean, these hearings used to go on for, Rob was telling us, we asked, did this used to go on for days? And he said, it went on for weeks. So it's a huge effort. But if that's what it takes, we're here to help you.
That's nice to know. We're for the government. We're here to help you, too.
Yes, exactly. We appreciate that.
And the check's in the mail. Representative has.
What you said, Mr. Chair, was, I think, very right on. I just have a nuts and bolts question for staff or for you about our automatic reconnecting abilities. I need a clarification upon where we automatically reconnect, where we have the option to do so, and what the distinction is.
You can probably answer that. It's really we reconnect on the definition of taxable income. That's the only place that we connect.
Only place.
Yeah. So when it gets to deductions and credits and depreciation and exemptions, all those things, we automatically reconnect because they figure into the definition of taxable income. Right?
Right.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say that I very much appreciate the clarification of the society's position, because I suspect there may be some occasions for us in the next little bit to ask for your help in figuring out how to work on some of these issues in ways that will have the lowest impact possible on the way people keep their records and prepare their returns, but at the same time get us the revenue we need to operate basic services in Oregon. So I very much appreciate that clarification.
Thank you. I appreciate Mr. Chairman and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk with you.
Any other questions or comments for these folks? Otherwise, I think I'll just we'll wind this hearing down. Obviously, we're not going to work session on this now. But I'm happy to continue the conversation. This is actually kind of fun. My four terms, I've actually kind of enjoyed these days when I get to look through your book and go section by section and see all these strange things that happen at the federal tax code. It's always entertaining. Okay, with that, colleagues, then we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2186, and with no further business before us today, no bill introduction or anything like that, we are adjourned until tomorrow.